From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hello to you. I'm Ira Melman.
Hello, Ira. I'm Jim Stevenson. On today's program, I speak with Gregory Moore. He's an author who talks about his new book. It's about North Korea's nuclear capabilities.
You'll hear from VOA reporter Haiyan in Hong Kong with the latest on the protest movement there and what's happening to it.
There's no official Thanksgiving observance in South Korea, but many are following the U.S. in a holiday buying spree.
Twins are in focus in the American Cafe.
And David Byrd explores how to brew a good cup of coffee while you're in orbit around the Earth.
A little difficult splashing all over the place. We'll check business and sports all on this edition of VOA Global from the Voice of America.
This is Daybreak Asia. Glad you could join me for a few minutes today for a summary of Asia news and events for Thursday, December 4th. I'm Jim Stevenson. In brief today, as Taiwan's Beijing-friendly president resigns as head of his party and protesters in Hong Kong talk about a longer-term struggle for democracy, Beijing has played it cool, downplaying the significance of recent tensions. Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
Several leaders of the Occupy Central movement and dozens of other pro-democracy protesters surrendered to authorities in Hong Kong Wednesday. But after filling out forms, they were released without charge. What happens next is uncertain. Priscilla Cho is one of the protesters who turned herself in to police.
I think, like many, many citizens in Hong Kong, I am grossly disappointed because there has not been any change in the government's stance towards this issue.
While some feel it is time to clear the streets, others have started a hunger strike in a bid to restart talks with the government. Beijing has dismissed the protesters as naive. But protesters who spoke with VOA say the recent weeks of demonstrations have awakened a new political movement.
Fighting democracy is not a short time we can do it. I, as well as the other protester, will try our best. If we can fight in these few years, maybe a few 10 years, our son, our grandson, will still fight for it until we see the truth, we see the hope.
Helen, a student protester who is studying to become a teacher, says through her participation in the protest, she feels more mature and knows how to care more about society.
Actually, I wanted to be a teacher, and in the past, I may just think I have to teach what I have to teach in school. But now I think it is very important to actually tell the student what is happening around in our society and what is the correct value that they should have in dealing with this situation.
Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Protesters in India have marked the 30th anniversary of a gas leak disaster in the central Indian town of Bhopal that killed more than 3,000 people. Activists say 25,000 others have died in the aftermath and that many other people continue to suffer physical and mental consequences from the poisoning. Zlatika Hoke reports the protesters want Union Carbide, now a subsidiary of the Dow Chemical Company, to be held fully responsible.
Protesters chanting slogans and carrying pictures of the victims marched in Bhopal Tuesday to demand justice. They burned an effigy representing Dow Chemical, the owner of Union Carbide, which they hold responsible for the disaster.
Union Carbide ka bhi symbol tha.
The multinationals should not be allowed to do business here without being responsible for what they do. The effigy we burn today is the symbol of our anger.
On the 3rd of December 1984,
a pesticide plant at Bhopal, run by Union Carbide, leaked about 40 tons of deadly methyl isocyanate gas into the air, creating the world's worst industrial disaster. Survivors and family members of the victims say they are still waiting for full compensation.
All my family got severely affected. Within 2 months after the disaster, my husband died. I also suffered very badly. I have lots of health issues. We had two bullocks at our house. They too died. So my sources of livelihood got severely impacted. We only received the minimum of health care.
Dow Chemical denies responsibility, saying the Indian government took control of the site in 1998. But many activists still blame the company.
We want to tell the government that they should open their eyes and at least hold Dow Chemical Company responsible in the Supreme Court and hold them responsible for destroying the next generation and ask them to take responsibility for the rehabilitation, treatment, and livelihood of the survivors and for them to lead a dignified life.
Eight former Union Carbide employees in Bhopal were convicted of causing death by negligence and were sentenced to 2 years imprisonment. Victims and activists say this is not enough.
In 30 years, we have achieved something, but what the gas affected deserved, we have not got that. Justice. The central government has not taken any action against the guilty companies so far.
Environmentalists warn that the Bhopal tragedy is not over because the toxic substances have contaminated soil and underground water and continue to pose a threat to area residents. Larissa Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
In South Korea, a conservative Christian organization received permission from the defense ministry to construct a new Christmas tree-shaped tower near the North Korean border. VOA's Brian Padden is in Seoul, and he tells us about the effort to build an overtly religious structure near the world's most heavily militarized border at a time of high tensions with the atheist North.
The Christian Council of Korea is planning to erect a 9-meter-tall Christmas tree tower on a high peak 3 kilometers from the border near a North Korean town. The tree is to be topped with a giant cross and illuminated with decorative lights during the Christmas season from December 23rd until January 6th. On Tuesday, South Korean Defense Ministry spokesman Kim Min-sok announced that the project will proceed. He says the Ministry of Defense has approved the request considering the purpose of the lighting ceremony and to guarantee religious activities. This is actually a replacement tower for an aging similar structure that was dismantled in October because of safety concerns. North Korea had complained that the older structure was an act of propaganda warfare and warned against any attempt to rebuild the tower. Religious activities in North Korea are restricted to officially recognized groups linked to the government. Authorities there have jailed missionaries for trying to proselytize. In South Korea, surveys indicate about 29% of the population identifies as Christian, 23% as Buddhist, and 46% report no religious affiliation at all. The border area, known as the Demilitarized Zone, has been guarded on both sides by thousands of soldiers, tanks, artillery, and landmines. And in the past, small provocations have led to limited clashes and casualties on both sides. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Join me again tomorrow for Daybreak Asia. Heard every weekday on VOA Global. It's a podcast as well, to which you may subscribe for free at voanews.com.
If you are wondering where you are on the internet, you are at VOA Global from the Voice of America in Washington, and we're going to hear from some of our listeners about a story we did about China slamming a report by a corruption watchdog. The story is that China is dismissing a report by a global corruption monitoring group that said graft is worsening over the past year, despite Beijing's intensive focus on the issue. Think about it from the United States says China is going backwards just like Russia. China gets what it wants and then backstabs not only its own people, but the outsiders who helped it succeed. China, like Russia, is headed full speed in reverse.
William the Conqueror Worm from the United States writes, as the report clearly shows, when it comes to fighting corruption, China is a paper tiger.
And Mean Bill says, Paul Watson, co-founder of Greenpeace, quote, said it best, it doesn't matter what's true, it only matters what they believe to be true. All right, then there's the next story. An international human rights group says India is forcing women and girls with disabilities into mental institutions where they're treated worse than animals.
Amazed writes to us, firebrand speeches and glittering promises of economic uplift by the Indian Prime Minister are tools to fool the West. I'm glad VOA ventured into this painful saga of Indian hypocrisy, both on governmental and social levels. What a selfish society. Let the U.S. president take them to task by suspending, denying all promised privileges unless issues like these are tackled.
That is our attempt to let you in on our program. We want to hear from you. Just write to us at
VOA Asia at voanews.com. You can also contact us on Facebook, Twitter, and Weibo. This is VOA Global on the Voice of America. Jim Stevenson along with Ira Melman. Coming up, we've got the latest news from China with Sarah Williams and China Focus as she talks about what's happening with Occupy Central in Hong Kong.
All kinds of stuff happening with that. And following that, we will check the Asian market. Some interesting things happening as far as the financial picture throughout Asia is concerned. The Hong Kong market yesterday had a good day following one of its worst days in years and years. Stay with us.
North Korea has for more than 20 years been on a path to achieving the coupling of a nuclear weapon with an effective delivery system. The North's ambitions has raised the question, is a regional arms race inevitable? I'm Jim Stevenson with Authors on Asia. We open the book today with Gregory Moore, Associate Professor of International Relations at Zhejiang University in Hangzhou, China. Moore gathered leading experts in Asian and security studies to examine the issue. The result is a new book titled North Korean Nuclear Operationality, which Moore edited and has written some of the chapters.
I'd written a couple of pieces on North Korea, and it kind of came together, I guess, back in 2009, I think it was. I invited some of these folks to a conference in New York, and so it kind of started to come together. So I ended up writing four of the chapters. I think the book is timely. Kim Jong-il died in late 2011, which threw a little bit of a wrench in our plans with the recent, should I call, execution, murder, whatever one wants to call that, purge of Chang Song-taek, the uncle. We can see it's still a pretty traditionally authoritarian, or probably better word, totalitarian regime.
We did have a sense of, I guess, normalcy while the uncle was alive, because he was very close to China, and that seemed to be the real link between North Korea and China. And without him now, it has to make the Chinese nervous, especially with North Korea's nuclear capabilities at this point and seemingly their interest in expanding their capabilities.
You put that well. I think that uncle was sort of a pragmatist, was more of a moderate force in the government. And with his departure, that's a question now. You know, what does that mean? Is that it doesn't bode well, frankly, for the region, and it doesn't bode well for the United States policy towards North Korea. And like you said, I think the Chinese are kind of really wondering, you know, what's going to happen now. My guess would be that this introduces a bit more tension. If you read my chapter on North Korea-China relations, I've argued that there's already been a lot of tension, actually, in the last 20 years, starting in 1994 in particular, exactly 20 years now, when North Korea really sort of went over the edge into that nuclear realm and forced a showdown with the United States.
What is China's main concern with a nuclear North Korea at this point?
China has sort of two main concerns. One is the nuclear issue, but also it's the issue of the collapse of North Korea, which is related to this nuclear thing. Now, what China's worried about is North Korea pushing forward as a nuclear weapons state, as an operational nuclear weapons capability, is what the book's premise is. The key issue is they're worried that it's going to cause some sort of regional conflict. The division in the region, traditional Cold War lines with China, North Korea, and maybe Russia on one side, and Japan, South Korea, and the U.S. on another side. I think that's their main concern. The other issue is that they're worried about a regime collapse where thousands and thousands of poor North Koreans would flow across the border into northeast China and destabilize China.
As far as nuclear capability goes, are sanctions working in keeping its nuclear program at least at a slower pace?
The sanctions probably certainly have slowed things down. That would seem certain. There are really two ways to produce weapons-grade material that's necessary for nuclear weapons. One is through enrichment, and the other one is through reprocessing spent fuel rods. The reprocessing method has been what North Korea has been using historically for the last 20 years. Evidence suggests that they may have mastered the enrichment process as well, which I think is probably more fruitful in the long run. And so I think they've become fairly self-sufficient now at this point, and that's a worry, really, for us, which makes them more invulnerable to sanctions than they might have been 20 years ago.
Gregory Moore, Associate Professor of International Relations at Zhejiang University in Hangzhou, China. He edited and wrote parts of the new book, North Korean Nuclear Operationality. It's published by Johns Hopkins. I'm Jim Stevenson. We'll pull another volume from our bookshelves next Thursday when you may hear more authors on Asia on VOA Global or anytime by visiting the voanews.com website.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. In Hong Kong, Occupy Central founders Benny Tai, Chan Kin Mon, and Chu Yu Ming were released after turning themselves in to police. I spoke with VOA reporter Hai Yan.
They just turned themselves in to file a report, like sort of a police report. So that's why they were not given bail or put them on parole, or they were just simply released. But police said if needed, the police will go and question them in the future.
So they potentially they could be prosecuted at a later date.
Yes, according to Benny Dai Yaoting, because he said he went into the police with his attorney for questioning, and then they filled out specially designed forms by police for occupiers. It seems listing 708 different offenses. And he selects one, which is participation in illegal or unauthorized assembly. After he came out of the police division headquarters, he disclosed to the media that he might be charged with other crimes, such as help to organize an illegal or unauthorized assembly.
Well, at the moment, what is the status of the protests? I believe there are some protesters are still out, although I know that officials have cleared up some of the sites.
Yes, co-founders of the Occupy Central have called on the students still in the Occupy areas to withdraw and turn the Occupy movement into a pro-democratic movement and spread it to the communities in Hong Kong, because they were worried that the police were becoming more and more aggressive in cracking down on the protests, and they were worried about the safety of the students. And then today, they called on the students to withdraw from the occupied areas again. And also, their surrendering to the police were met with different opinions. With most of the occupiers I talked with, the young people, the students, were mostly against surrendering to the police at this time of the movement. They think the government did not make any compromise or has not given in an inch, and they want to continue their fight. They want to continue their occupation to being arrested or cleared by the police.
Now, I know that one of the student leaders, Joshua Wong, he's involved in a hunger strike. I believe he and two other students are doing that.
Oh, yes. I'm right by their tent where they are staging their hunger strike since the 10 p.m. on last Monday. And right now, they're receiving medical help as they're not feeling well because they only drink water without drinking any juice or anything else or eating anything else. So their health declines rapidly at the moment. At noon, they issued an open letter to the chief executive, Levi Leung, asking him to restart a dialogue with the students and promise to restart the five steps of political consultation process. But the Hong Kong government this afternoon issued a statement saying the students' demand was impractical and illegal because according to the decisions by the National People's Congress, 2017 chief executive election will be carried out based on the basic law and the decision made by the National People's Congress on August 31st. And they said the Hong Kong government was not allowed and will not to restart the five steps of the political reform.
Reporter Haiyan in Hong Kong. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
With Jim Stevenson, I'm Ira Melman on the Voice of America, checking the Asian business markets. Japan's benchmark Nikkei 225 index ended 0.3% higher after briefly touching its highest level since 2007. In China, Hong Kong's Hang Seng lost 1%, and the Shanghai Composite Index in mainland China gained 0.6%. A dollar rose to 119.73 yen. The weakening yen, driven by the government's monetary easing aimed at stimulating the economy, is good for the nation's big exporters like Toyota and Canon because it makes their cars and electronics cheaper overseas.
The airbag controversy may have inflated a bit more. Takata Corporation defied a U.S. safety agency's demand for a nationwide recall of driver's side airbags. That sets the stage for possible legal action by the government and leaves some drivers to wonder about the safety of their cars. In a Tuesday letter to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration obtained by the Associated Press, Takata said its own data and testing support limiting the recall to high humidity areas such as along the Gulf Coast. A Takata official repeated those claims Wednesday at a hearing before a House subcommittee.
South Korea does not celebrate Thanksgiving, at least officially, but the hot deals at U.S. online retailers during the holiday season are changing the shopping habits of South Koreans, who are aggrieved at marked-up prices of locally made and imported goods at hometown stores. The volume of goods ordered by Korean shoppers from websites overseas has surged in recent years, and sales are forecast to set a record high year above $1 billion. It remains small compared with retail sales within South Korea, which are forecast at $243 billion this year, but is expanding at a faster rate.
We check Asian business news every weekday on VOA Global.
This is Today in History. On December 4th, 1619, colonists from Berkeley Parish in England stepped ashore along the James River in what is now Virginia and, in accordance with the instructions of their captain, dropped to their knees and offered prayers of thanksgiving for their safe arrival in the New World. In 1829, the British governor of India issued a regulation declaring that all who abet suti, the practice of widows throwing themselves on the funeral pyres of their dead husbands, were guilty of homicide. On this date in 1982, the People's Republic of China adopted its current constitution. In 1844, James K. Polk was elected the 11th president of the United States. At his inauguration, the song Hail to the Chief was used for the first time to announce the arrival of the president. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
VOA Global from the Voice of America in Washington. If your name is Kim Jong-un and you live in North Korea and you're not the leader, you're in trouble.
Yes, apparently. Apparently you've got to change your name now.
Yeah, North Korea has imposed a ban on anyone with the name of Kim Jong-un.
Or its two former leaders.
Yeah, North Korea imposed similar bans on the use of the names of its leaders, his grandfather, the current leader's grandfather, and his father. Kim Jong-un's name is not allowed for newborns. People who share the name must not just stop using it, but must change it on their birth certificates and resident registrations.
I wonder how they find out, Ira. Do they go through the North Korean phone book?
I don't know, and I wonder how many pages have the leader's name on it.
Latest world news is next with Michael Lippin.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. Coming up, the top U.S. diplomat says defeating the Islamic State militant group could take years. The release of a new global corruption index shows the problem of bribery remains widespread. And U.S. President Barack Obama gives his assessment of the performance of his Chinese counterpart. I'm Michael Lippin. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says it will take years for the international community to defeat the Islamic State militant group. But speaking Wednesday in Brussels, Kerry said coalition airstrikes against the insurgents have made it much harder for them to launch attacks. Kerry was attending a meeting with foreign ministers from 60 coalition partners of the United States to discuss efforts to combat the militant group that took over large areas of northern and western Iraq and eastern Syria earlier this year.
One outcome of this meeting will be a statement that encompasses our message, that we are united and moving ahead on all fronts, and that we will engage in this campaign for as long as it takes to prevail.
The coalition says it has carried out more than 1,000 airstrikes in Iraq and Syria since beginning its campaign in August. Meanwhile, Iran is denying a U.S. claim that it has carried out its own airstrikes in Iraq. U.S. military officials say Iran has used American-built jets that it bought in the 1970s to strike Islamic State targets in eastern Iraq's Diyala province. They say U.S. forces do not operate in that area. But both Iran and the United States have said there is no military cooperation between them. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has claimed responsibility for a deadly bombing in Yemen targeting an Iranian diplomat's house. A Twitter message from an account linked to the Sunni militants said they carried out Wednesday's car bomb attack on the residence of the Iranian ambassador in Sana'a, Hossein Niknam. Yemeni officials say Niknam was not at the home when the bomb went off. There were conflicting reports on the number of people killed in the incident, with at least one death confirmed and two others reported. At least 17 other people were wounded. Global anti-corruption organization Transparency International has released its annual corruption ratings for countries around the world. Using a scale of 0 to 100, with 100 meaning the most free of corruption and 0 being the most corrupt, more than two-thirds of the world's nations scored below 50. VOA's Sharon Bain has more.
Somalia, Afghanistan, Sudan, Iraq, and North Korea, countries ravaged by conflict and repression, are ranked among nations perceived to be the most corrupt in the world, according to the report by the Better Governance Group Transparency International. At the other end of the scale, the Scandinavian nations and New Zealand ranked at the top of the 2014 tally as the least corrupt. Daniel Dudish, Transparency International's senior policy director in Washington, says without effective anti-corruption laws, economically challenged countries will have a difficult time attracting increased foreign aid or badly needed business investments.
If they see countries that are very poorly ranked on the Corruption Perceptions Index, that may give them pause before they invest in a new project, develop a new subsidiary, buy perhaps an existing company in that country.
The group notes that unstable security environments, violence, and war have made it easier for corruption to flourish. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Washington.
The United States has repeated its support for Hong Kong's efforts to achieve universal suffrage in the autonomous Chinese territory. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Daniel Russell said Wednesday the people of Hong Kong should have a meaningful choice of candidates for the territory's leadership post when the next election is held in 2017. Russell rejected accusations from Chinese state-run media that Hong Kong's ongoing pro-democracy protest movement is being orchestrated by the United States and other Western countries. Three of the founders of the Occupy Central movement turned themselves in to Hong Kong police on Wednesday. It was a gesture aimed at showing the public that the activists are ready to bear the legal consequences of organizing street occupations that the government has called illegal. Well, U.S. President Barack Obama has offered his views about U.S. relations with China and Russia, voicing optimism about U.S. links with Beijing, but pessimism about the increasingly antagonistic exchanges with Moscow. Mr. Obama made his comments on Wednesday at a business forum here in Washington. He had some praise for Chinese President Xi Jinping.
He has consolidated power faster and more comprehensively than probably anybody since Deng Xiaoping. Everybody's been impressed by his, you know, his clout inside of China after only a year and a half or 2 years.
But Mr. Obama said President Xi's growing clout also raises dangers on the issue of human rights and cracking down on dissent. But he said he sees China as having a very strong interest in maintaining good relations with the U.S. Mr. Obama said he is less optimistic about relations with Russia and especially its president, Vladimir Putin. The American leader said he has a very direct, blunt, and business-like relationship with Mr. Putin. New data show the Ebola outbreak is intensifying in Sierra Leone, even as it stabilizes or drops off in other West African countries. The World Health Organization says Sierra Leone reported 537 new confirmed cases in the week ending November 30th, a jump of more than 150 over the week before. In its latest update on Wednesday, the WHO says transmission remains persistent and intense across Sierra Leone, with the exception of the south. The worst affected area was the capital Freetown, where more than 200 new cases were reported. The World Meteorological Organization says 2014 is on track to be the hottest year on record. The UN agency says land and sea temperatures around the globe were above average from January through October, and the trend is likely to continue. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WMO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Meteorological Organization reports the record heat is largely due to very high global sea surface temperatures, which will very likely remain above normal into 2015. WMO notes the high temperatures recorded since January occurred in the absence of a fully developed El Niño, the weather phenomenon that warms Pacific Ocean water and causes a subsequent warming of the atmosphere. El Niño years tend to be very warm. The Meteorological Agency's Secretary General Michel Giraud says the provisional information for 2014 means that 14 of the 15 warmest years on record have occurred in the 21st century. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And just a quick update here on Israel. Lawmakers there have agreed to hold new elections on March 17th after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he would dissolve the current parliament as soon as possible. Well, that's it for International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. We'll see you next time.
This is Business News on VOA Global. Jim Stevenson along with Ira Melman. U.S. stocks rose Wednesday with both the Dow and S&P 500 ending at records as data pointed to improving conditions in the U.S. services sector, boosting cyclical stocks. Both the Dow and S&P also hit intraday records in a quiet session, with many traders looking ahead to tomorrow's key meeting of the European Central Bank. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 33 points to 17,912. The S&P 500 gained almost 8 points to close at 2074, and the NASDAQ Composite added 18.66 points. It closed at 4774.
There is a report out that says Sony Corporation, Sony Pictures Entertainment, will name North Korea as the source of the hacking attack that knocked out the company's computer systems for over a week. That report comes from the tech blog Recode, and it cites two sources close to the investigation. However, a representative for Sony told the Hollywood Reporter newspaper that the story is wrong and that the company will not be making a statement on the attack. If you have not kept up on this story, North Korean government has denounced as an act of war the film called The Interview, comedy about a CIA plot to assassinate the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
If you're in the United States, you're probably not watching as much television as you used to. Traditional television dropped nearly 4% last quarter as online video streaming jumped 60%. That's according to a new report from Nielsen, crystallizing a trend for TV channel owners amid ratings declines. The average American still watched more than 141 hours of live television a month last quarter, more than 4 hours a day. But that number is down from 4% from the third quarter of last year. That's business news on VOA Global.
This is VOA Global from the Voice of America, and we have a present for you. All you have to do is let us know that you're listening to us. We kind of like to know how you're listening to us as well. Hopefully it's with your ears, but nevertheless, for you, we have a present.
That's right, a 2015 VOA calendar. All you have to do is write to us at voaasia@voanews.com. Please include your postal address.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Being a twin can often be a blessing and a curse at the same time. Psychotherapist Joan Friedman, who specializes in twin issues, is a twin herself, and she's the mother of fraternal twins. She says when most twins reach adulthood, they struggle to learn how to face life as singletons. In this story narrated by Faith Lapidus, Faiza Al-Masri tells us more on the challenges of being a twin.
When Joan Friedman and her identical twin sister Jane were growing up half a century ago, there were few twins around.
We were very much stars and got a lot of attention, and people always knew we were the Friedman twins. But then as we became older and you wanted to have your own identity, people really didn't know who we were. And it was a sense of sort of like being noticed but not being known.
Like many twins back then and even today, Joan and Jane dressed alike and were always together.
The first time Jane and I were separated was when we went to college, and it was an incredibly difficult adjustment. All of a sudden, you find yourself sort of as a very unprepared singleton.
And she says, twins are often still treated as two halves of a whole rather than as separate individuals.
People just project a lot of their own concerns to separate twins. You're breaking the twin connection. You're going to in some way interfere with their loving one another.
We've been around each other for our entire lives, and, you know, we're trying to separate.
22-year-old Nazi Farkunde and her twin sister Rana have always been inseparable best friends. They went to the same school, had the same friends. Though they applied to different colleges, they ended up together at the University of Michigan as roommates and graduated with the same major. Now they both live in Los Angeles, California.
The funnest part is probably just always having a companion that you can count on. The most challenging part is just feeling that everything is kind of a shared experience when you want to have your own experience.
Farkunde also says people perceive twins as the same person, while in fact, they are very different.
Our styles are completely different. She's more of a, you know, girly girl. She likes to do her makeup. She likes to do her hair when she goes out. I'm more casual. I don't really wear any makeup, and I never do my hair. I'm more into, like, literature, and she's more into music. And even growing up, I was always a little bit more outgoing, and she was a shyer one.
Like most siblings, twins often disagree with one another.
It's really funny. There's actually like a huge irony in disagreeing with your twin, because on one hand, you appreciate it because it's the way that you differentiate yourself from them. But on the other hand, it's just kind of more irritating because like somebody who's really, really, really close to you disagreeing with you. So in that sense, it kind of burns more.
Twin boys process their differences differently than twin girls, says psychotherapist Joan Friedman.
Identical twin girls have the closest relationships just because girls tend to need and find, you know, more intimacy with one another. Identical twin girls really do try to keep the competition under wraps, whereas boys will be able to express their feelings or their hostility in a more open way.
In her new book, The Same But Different, How Twins Can Live, Love, and Learn to Be Individuals, Friedman offers this advice for raising independent twins.
I have certain things that I always tell parents, which is, of course, not to dress them alike and not to give them alliterative names like, you know, Tom and Tony and Natalie and Nancy, but to give them different names. Make sure you take separate pictures of each twin. If they grow up and never see a picture of themselves by themselves, it's very difficult for them to think about them as separate.
Reinforcing different personalities and nurturing different temperaments, Joan Friedman says, is key to raising happy, close twins who have their own individual goals and paths in life. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. You can join us on voanews.com as well as on a podcast on social media.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. Are you like me? Do you love a good cup of coffee in the morning? But how do you make coffee if you're, let's say, an astronaut on the International Space Station? As Lanitza Hoke tells us now, some Italian inventors and a coffee manufacturer have come up with an answer to that question.
Many people cannot imagine life without coffee, and for most Italians, coffee means espresso, a thick brew prepared in a special coffee machine.
Without coffee, I don't think I would be able to survive. It's not a life.
So when Italian astronaut Samantha Cristoforetti headed for the International Space Station, her compatriots worried how she would survive there for 6 months, drinking only instant coffee.
I believe that when working as an astronaut, a job in which you have to reason a lot, reflect, and be attentive, espresso is definitely very important.
To help Cristoforetti and other espresso lovers in orbit, the famed Turin-based coffee maker Lavazza and engineering firm Argotech, which specializes in making space food, joined forces to produce a coffee machine that would work at zero gravity.
We had to figure out how to make coffee on the station exactly like we make it on Earth. The other difficulty was complying with safety measures in order to qualify the machine as onboard software on the International Space Station.
The machine called ISS Espresso overcomes the absence of gravity by firing pressurized water through capsules of coffee. Cristoforetti took it with her for testing when she blasted off into orbit on November 23rd.
The concept of this machine was for an experiment. So we started as a technology demonstration experiment, but NASA was very much interested in getting this machine and keeping most likely this machine for a long time. So not only for brewing a few coffees, but actually for keeping on the station. So this means that most likely, if everything goes well after the technology demonstration, the machine will be kept on the International Space Station, available for all the astronauts that we're rotating on the station.
Italians consider themselves great connoisseurs of coffee, perhaps with good reason.
We are very proud, not only as Italians, but also as residents of Turin. The first espresso machine was created in Turin in 1884, so about 130 years ago. And today, in 2014, another two Turin-based realities, Lavazza and Argotech, developed a machine that will bring espresso not only across the world, but even in space.
Besides espresso, the ISS espresso machine is capable of preparing tea and clear soup. Larissa Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
From coffee in space to space-aged technology now, some entrepreneurs have come up with a way to make a skateboard hover above the ground, like Marty McFly in the movie Back to the Future. George Putich tells us how.
Neutral repulsion between the same poles of two magnets can counteract the force of gravity and make an object levitate or hover in space. Since the 1980s, that principle has been employed in so-called maglev trains in Europe, Japan, and China that hover above the track. Architect Greg Henderson, who found the company ArcSpax with his wife Jill, says the same technology can make anything hover, even buildings.
Imagine that there's an earthquake and the early warning system turns on the hover systems and the supports fall away as the building starts to hover. The shaking stops, who supports return, and no one in that room or that building ever knew there was an earthquake.
As a proof of the concept, Henderson's company created the first maglev hoverboard called Hendo, capable of holding a single person about 2.5 centimeters above a metal surface. For now, batteries that power Hendo's four engines last only for a short time. Hendo's creators say they do not expect to see their hoverboard on the streets anytime soon because it only works on a metal-covered surface. But they say larger hover engines could be used for transporting containers, for instance, within a warehouse. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
So, what do you think? Let us know your opinion on these stories by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. If you want to see video of these stories, visit our webpage, www.voanews.com. Until next time, I'm David Berg.
This is VOA Global from the Voice of America with Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman. 911, a lot of you know what that is. Every country seemingly has its own emergency telephone code. Mm-hmm. That's what ours is here in the United States, is 911.
Right.
Some kids used it.
Right, and they used it in a creative way. They wanted to get in touch with Santa Claus.
They dialed the emergency number.
I guess they figured that was the fastest way to reach him.
Police were not happy. This is Sports from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman with Jim Stevenson. The new European Tour golf season opens this week, Thursday, as a matter of fact, in South Africa at the Nedbank Golf Challenge. That's in Sun City, with three former top-ranked players among those looking to get a jump on the 2014 Money List winner. And number one, Mr. McIlroy, Nick Dye is there with a preview.
It's only a fortnight since the majority of the 30-man field here were contesting the last event of the 2014 season. Louis Oosthuizen finished superbly in Dubai, and with the former Open champion back on home soil at a venue where he's won before, he's considered one of the favourites. Former Masters champion Charles Schwartzel also flies the flag for the home nation in a tournament which has an illustrious list of former winners. Bjorn is hoping a return to a place where he won in style can reignite his game, while Lee Westwood, twice a champion here, Martin Keimer, Jamie Donaldson, and Stephen Gallagher are sure to play their parts.
Nick Dye reporting. The funeral for cricketer Philip Hughes turned into a celebration of his life Wednesday, despite the grief and sorrow still evident from his death. Australia captain Michael Clarke and the rest of the Test squad were joined by former and current players from around the world, as well as friends and relatives from Hughes' hometown.
Hockey lost one of its great names over the past 24 hours. Jean Béliveau, who won 10 Stanley Cups with the Montreal Canadiens and become one of the most revered figures in the sport, died Tuesday at the age of 83. A supremely skilled center who spent 18 full seasons and parts of two others with Montreal. Béliveau was also a popular ambassador for the sport. He scored 507 goals and captained the Canadiens for 10 seasons before his retirement in 1971.
In the National Basketball Association, Stephen Curry made a go-ahead three-pointer with 2.2 seconds remaining as the Golden State Warriors beat the Orlando Magic 98-97 late Tuesday. That was their 10th straight win. Also, the Mavericks topped the Bulls in two overtime sessions, 132-129. The Pelicans topped the Thunder, 112-104. The Raptors were 117-109 winners against the Kings. The Cleveland Cavaliers topping the Milwaukee Bucks, 111-108. That's sports on VOA Global. Time for music on VOA Global. A Kurt Cobain documentary that's been in the works since 2007 will finally be released next year. Kurt Cobain Montage of Heck will be the documentary. Let's hear a little bit of Kurt Cobain and Nirvana, Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Love punk comes, bring your friends.
Check it out, the new documentary on Kurt Cobain and Nirvana coming out soon. That's music on VOA Global.
This is VOA Global from the Voice of America with Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman. Jim, one of my favorite movies of all time is Mel Brooks' Young Frankenstein.
Oh, it's all right? Fantastic. So funny and creative.
And one of the great, great scenes is when the wrong brain is chosen for Frankenstein. And there was a whole lineup of brains in formaldehyde. Guess what? The same thing happened in
reality.
Texas. Yes.
This is real.
School officials say dozens of human brains reported missing from the University of Texas Research Lab in Austin were actually destroyed about 12 years ago because they were in poor condition. The university released a statement Wednesday saying environmental workers disposed of between 40 and 60 jars, some of which contained multiple brains, after faculty members said the specimens weren't suitable for research or teaching purposes. This was a big, big story throughout the United States all day, both on air, online, everybody tweeting about it. There was one report that said one of the brains that was missing belonged to Charles Whitman. He's the guy who shot 16 people to death from the university's clock tower back in 1966. That was a huge, huge story, but it didn't happen, and they were destroyed. So it was a story that really meant nothing, but it was still a lot of fun to talk about. Time to say goodbye for this day, and we want to thank people who helped us put this program together. Our director, as always, Tracy Carter. Our technical director, Zeynab Abdul-Rahman and Carl Starling. And our managing editor is Diane Gao. Have a great day. Jim?
Keep your brain out of the jar.
Please. Jar means